Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour,
what is behind the rise and protection of the super rich and the creation of a winner-take-all politics?
Then on the Scholar Circle, most Americans revere the U.S. Constitution, but some scholars say our problems in the U.S. may be rooted in that founding document. We'll dissect some of those provisions and the culture that keeps them in place.
The concentration of wealth at the very top of the income pyramid has been noted for many years. But what is causing its continued growth? Our next guests argue that it's not caused necessarily by economic issues alone, so much as political systems. How did we get here, and what's the way out? We're joined by two professors, Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson. Jacob Hacker is professor of political science at Yale University and author of The Great Risk Shift. Paul Pearson is professor of political science at UC Berkeley and the author of Politics and Time and Dismantling the Welfare State. They've both come together once before and written Off-Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Well, so perhaps we should start with the actual numbers. You have noted that it's been very hard to get the numbers historically, but that now there have been a couple of economists that tracked it down. How do they look?
You're absolutely right. It's difficult to look at what's happening at the very top of the income pyramid because most of the evidence we have is based on surveys, and there are not a huge number of rich people in the United States, and they tend not to respond to phone interviews. So what has happened in the last 10 years or so is that people have started to really hone in on a unique source of evidence, which we call DNA evidence, namely income tax statistics, which give us a clearer picture than we've ever had of where the rewards of economic growth are going. And what we find is that they're going not just to the top, say the top 10% of Americans, but really to the tiny slices at the very top, the top 1%, the top 1/10 of 1%, even the top 1/100 of 1%. And let me give you a concrete number here. The Congressional Budget Office, using these same income tax statistics, calculated that in 2005, which is the last year they broke it out this way, that the top 1/100 of 1%, that's the richest 11,000 households, had an after-tax income that averaged $24 million a year. And that was up from $4 million average for this group back in 1979. That's a remarkable change. And just to give you a sense of comparison, the middle fifth, the middle 20% of Americans, saw their incomes over this 1979 to 2005 period go from $41,000 a year to $50,000 a year. So we're really talking about a degree of concentration of income at the top that is remarkable and that is sustained. It's happened over the last 30 or 40 years, and that has resulted in relatively little trickle down to those lower than the top on the economic ladder.
Paul, would you like to add anything?
The numbers are really astonishing, but just to emphasize this point and how concentrated it is, I mean, I think that's one of the things that is most puzzling to us. People have talked about inequality for a long time, but the fact that the winner's circle is so small really raises interesting and, we think, troubling questions about how the American economy is working, and leading from that, how American democracy is working or isn't working.
Now, Paul Pearson, you've got a colleague over there at UC Berkeley that we've had on this air a few times and that I had worked with while I worked in the legislature, who's a historian who also tracked real income and how much that has shifted for people beyond just this kind of straight-up income, where he looked at things such as, look, you know, you can't even go to a national park anymore without coughing up more money. You can't go to a zoo. You can't go to a museum. School fees have gone up. Did you guys calculate for any of that?
Well, we didn't look so much at the consumption side, what people are spending things on and how much they cost, but we looked in quite a bit of detail at all the different kinds of income, both what people earn but also what they get from government programs, private health insurance, and so on. All of that is calculated into some of these distributional figures. And because some conservatives have argued that, well, you don't take into account things like health care benefits and, you know, things would look more equal, so you're exaggerating how much inequality has grown. But in fact, when you take all those things into account, you still see the same results.
This is Jacob. I would add that we also look at whether or not the middle class has gotten ahead on other indicators. You know, it's clear that most of the economic gains have gone to the the richest of the rich. And that's what the statistics are showing uniquely. For the first time, we have evidence that's definitive on this point. But we also looked at whether social mobility, for example, the degree to which people move up the income ladder has accelerated when in this period of rising inequality, or whether health insurance and pension coverage has expanded, or whether people are less likely to have debt or go bankrupt or see their house foreclosed, or how many hours people are working. And just running down the list on all those indicators, the picture looks even worse when you expand your view beyond income and benefits to take into account social mobility and hours of work and so on. And I think this is really why it's so puzzling that this has happened. We ask two questions in the book. We ask, why did this occur? And we argue that policy and what government did and didn't do played a really important role. And so the second question is really, well, how? How did this happen in a democracy where we would expect the middle class to have tremendous political sway, and where these trends have taken place over a 30 or 40 year period?
And before we get into exactly how that happened in the tracing of it, as you did throughout this book, Winner Take All Politics, I really quickly want to look at what you wrote about Europe, how you compared the U.S. to Europe and what you found the difference was.
The fact is that the United States isn't the only country that's experienced rising globalization and increasing reliance on technology, but it's one of the few nations that has experienced a big increase in winner-take-all inequality of the sort that we described, where the gains are going very much to the very top. And of the countries that have experienced that kind of trend, we're far and away the country in which that's been the most pronounced. And I think that raises serious questions about the view that this is somehow inevitably linked to changes in our economy or society, because many of those changes have occurred in other nations that haven't experienced these kind of runaway gains at the top. But it also, of course, allows us to say that there are other economic models that have produced different outcomes. And so we did look to see if Europe, which has experienced much less of a rise in inequality as the United States has, whether or not they had not experienced, say, American levels of economic growth, whether or not there was a kind of a silver lining to the cloud of American inequality. And we did not find evidence of that. And actually, it's surprising how close American economic expansion and European economic expansion are over the 30 or 40 year period we're looking at.
And you also looked across to see if it was educational differences or if it was a skill-based difference, and you essentially rejected all of that because some people with the same education are doing so much better.
Yeah, and I think you don't have to look across the nations to really see that it can't just be that education and skills that are at the heart of the story here. You know, the most common story is that this is about the college-educated pulling away from those who haven't gone to college. But what we're talking about is the very richest of the rich pulling away from the rest of Americans. And 30% of Americans have college degrees and about 10% have advanced degrees. Many of those who are outside the winner's circle are clearly highly educated. So this is really a story about how a very small slice of people have, to use the analogy from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, have received the golden ticket in their chocolate bars that has catapulted them into a world of great riches. And what we want to argue is not just that this is taking place and that it's quite distinctively American, but that it's closely linked to policy and politics, and I think very importantly and puzzlingly, that it has had very negative consequences for the broad middle class.
So let's look at this systemically for a second. And Paul Pearson, let's bring you back in. You point out aptly in the book that the tension really arises between democracy, which is supposed to be equality for all, and a capitalism, which is kind of property-based, ownership-based. So you write that this conflict is what brings it up, and you trace it a bit. So give us a little bit of the background there.
There's been a long-standing interest ever since democracy started to emerge in what its relationship would be to an economy that often had very high levels of inequality. And some people worried that voters would essentially confiscate the wealth of those who did have property. And others have worried, as we say, that the problem is going to be the opposite, that it's going to be democracy, that it's going to be squeezed or smothered by the wealthy because they'll be able to translate their disproportionate economic resources into disproportionate political power. And it's a long-standing not just a philosophical discussion, but a real discussion. The nation's founders discussed these kinds of issues at length and thought about how it'd be influenced as they were trying to introduce at least, you know, partial democracy to the United States. And these same issues, you know, show up again and again. They show up during the Progressive Era. They show up during the New Deal, and we're seeing them again today. And what we argue is that at least in the current era, there's much more of a risk of this, the second kind of problem, that is that growing inequality and economic power is going to translate into inequality in the political realm as well. And essentially what we try to do in the book is to show how that has happened over the last 30 or 40 years and to show how that control of government has really mattered for reshaping the economy. Just to come back for a second to what we were talking about before, part of the reason why so many economists have said, oh, well, yes, there's been an increase in inequality, but there's nothing really you can do about it. It's just changes in technology or globalization. Part of the reason they've taken that view is that they've argued, well, government itself doesn't really have that much of an effect on the way that the economy operates. And so we argue in considerable detail in the book that these economists have a very narrow view of how government influences the way that the economy works and the distribution of income and rewards within it. You know, financial regulation is obviously a very prominent example in much of what we've experienced, especially in the last decade. Incredible economic challenges are very closely connected to a political process that fueled financial deregulation. And we similarly show in the book that the decline of unions, which we think has made a huge difference, both for the distribution of economic rewards and for the distribution of political power, that this was not just sort of a benign economic process that government didn't have anything to do with. Government played a really important role in helping to shift power away from unions and towards business.
I'd actually like to, if we have time, get into how the globalization fits into it, because it really does. What happened in the U.S. in these shifts in policies, and you also note the changes in the courts with the trial lawyers and those types of things that also protected the very wealthy. But that now has been going on the international scale. So hopefully we can go back to that in just a minute. But before we do that, let me just remind our listeners first that we're speaking with Paul Pearson and Jacob Hacker, and they have co-authored Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. I'd like to back up and go into the 1970s. He started tracing it from World War II, but really 1970s, it was where the change started to be noticeable with the organization of a lot of the CEOs, the Chamber of Commerce, the Economic Roundtable, the Manufacturers Association, and these groups. So, Jacob, let's go back to you.
The 1970s are the forgotten decade of American politics. We tend to locate the roots of our current politics in the ideological clashes, particularly around cultural issues in the 1960s. But in fact, as we show in the book, it's really the 1970s that we see the big shifts that lead to our present economically and politically polarized era. And the year that we identify as the turning point is one that no one mentions, 1978. It was that year that business, as you said, had mobilized, and they started to flex their new organizational muscle around a series of issues, including labor law reform and a consumer protection agency that was being proposed, environmental regulation, and a whole host of other issues, energy. And the end result was that on all these issues, the business position and the conservative position won out, and there was a dramatic showdown in 1978 over labor law reform that involved one of the first sustained filibusters outside the civil rights area that was waged by none other than Orrin Hatch on the Senate floor. So there was just a remarkable shift in the political climate, and it can't be attributed to elections or to the balance of power overall in Congress and the White House. The Democrats, after all, had Congress at that time. The Democrats had the White House. But it was really linked to the changes in the organization of business. And just to give you a sense of this, because back in the 1960s and 70s, business was really quite disorganized. They were not active on a lot of issues. They didn't have a very extensive lobbying presence. Now, when we have 30 lobbyists per member of Congress in Washington, it's easy to forget in this era, back in the 1960s and 70s, that these issues just were not dominated by powerful economic interest groups that now kind of are the sort of major feature of our political climate. So the 1970s is this turning point. that brings to power a new, much more muscular, organized business community, along with a very up-and-coming conservative movement that has hitched its wagon to these new organizational realities.
And they were, as I understand, really a counter-movement to Ralph Nader, the environmental groups, and the labor unions that they believed were essentially hurting their profits. And so there was the Lewis Powell memo. You guys mentioned it. Paul, why don't you talk about who Lewis Powell is and what he said?
Well, Lewis Powell, who became famous when he had joined the Supreme Court, appointed by Nixon, prior to that had worked in a high-level position for the Chamber of Commerce. And there he penned a famous memo. We don't really want to treat the Powell memo as itself necessarily the catalyst to what happened. It's more symptomatic of a broader shift that was taking place, but it articulates the change in attitudes and behavior within the business community exceptionally well. So it's worth studying for that reason, not as sort of the original source of this movement. Powell basically said, look, we have got to become more politically organized. We are suffering, by we, he meant the business community, we're suffering major defeats in Washington. As you were saying, Maria, this comes towards the later part of a period where Nader and others were winning big victories in Washington, big expansions of environmental regulation and occupational safety legislation and other areas, a big expansion of Social Security. A lot of these things were happening even when you had Richard Nixon in the White House. So again, it's a reminder that while partisanship matters a lot in politics, the organizational playing field and the balance of organizational power also matters a lot. So even with the Republican in the White House, Powell was writing, we're still being badly outflanked by our opponents. So we need to organize. We need to be much more aggressive. We need to find ways to get different businesses to pool their resources and develop a long-term strategic plan and the capacity to execute that plan in politics. And so then you see a whole series of developments. As Jacob said, there's a huge expansion of lobbying. Groups like the Chamber of Commerce expand their organizational capacity. The Business Roundtable represents CEOs and involves a lot of active political participation by the CEOs of the very, very biggest American companies. Business Roundtable forms during this period and quickly becomes quite influential in Washington. The NAM, the National Association of Manufacturers, moves their office from New York, where it had been headquartered for, I think, a century or more, to Washington, because as the director of it said, you know, this is where the action is. We need to be in Washington. So just across the board, there's a huge increase in the political role of business that begins in the 1970s and has just accelerated since then.
There have been since then also some new groups that you mentioned in your book, such as the Club for Growth. And then come the 1980s and into the 1990s, this connection with the right-wing Christian groups. So, Jacob, why don't you take that and talk about that marriage?
Well, one of the things to understand is that this shift in businesses' organization and power was not occurring in a vacuum more generally. The big shift that was occurring simultaneously was a decline in what we call middle-class organization. Labor unions were obviously the biggest player in that middle-class organizational world, but they weren't the only middle-class organizations to lose ground. Voluntary federations and fraternal organizations were also losing out to much more professional, much more Washington-oriented and lobbyist-centered organizations. And in terms of the Democratic Party's coalition, they were losing out to what might be called post-material groups, that is, groups that were organized not around bread-and-butter economic concerns, but about issues that resonated with professional and more affluent members of the Democratic coalition, notably feminism, environmentalism. And this shift in the basis of the Democratic Party was occurring, of course, in a different way on the Republican Party side. The big shift for the Republicans is they did bring evangelical Christian conservatives into the fold. This was a very interesting marriage. It was brokered at the elite level by activists in the Christian conservative movement who were particularly angry, not about Roe v. Wade, because it actually, the alliance formed later, but they were very angry about threats that they perceived to Christian schools, particularly in the early 1980s, and grew out of fights over the tax-free status of these schools. And these activists felt very strongly that Christian conservatives
voters should be aligned with the Republican Party, and they very skillfully brought that alliance into being. Now, there are a lot of commentators who talk about this as if Christian conservative voters are confused about their interests, that because lower-income evangelical voters are more likely to vote for Republican than lower-income secular or non-evangelical voters, that indicates some kind of mistake on the part of these voters. That's not our point at all. Our point is that this was a really important way in which the business community and more affluent members of the Republican coalition were able to enlarge the coalition behind their positions, and this would only have had that kind of effect were it not for the fact that there were those changes that were taking place on the other side with the decline of unions and other voluntary organizations. So the result is that the organizational landscape transforms over this period, and policy and politics shift in response. And we describe this almost as if it's a change in the ecosystem of Washington, that there's this new set of organizational realities, and that changes the kinds of species that can find a niche in the Washington policy jungle and political jungle. And so both parties get dramatically transformed over the next 30 years in ways that reinforce both policy and politics that is conducive to these very concentrated rewards at the top of the economic ladder, to the winner-take-all economy.
One of the sections of your book is called Making America Safe for CEOs. And you were talking about all of these measures, including placing limits on labor unions and limits on ability to file lawsuits against corporate CEOs and corporations, that protected the very rich. Talk about some of these policies that safeguarded CEOs legally.
The list is long, but I think, this is Paul, the core point I think that one would want to make about CEOs, and again, this is just one piece of the connection between Washington and the winner-take-all economy. I think you'd also want to think about what's happened to the financial industry for sure, taxes, where there have been huge changes that favor the wealthy, what's happened to labor unions. In this case, the thing that we're most interested in is really the way in which corporate governance has evolved in the U.S. in a way that favors the capacity of CEOs to come pretty close to writing their own paychecks. You know, they have docile boards of directors that get a lot of perks from being on boards and are often appointed just sort of one step removed from the CEOs who they then turn around and set salaries for. And as everyone knows, the salaries of CEOs have skyrocketed over the past generation, and typically have skyrocketed in ways that don't seem to bear much connection to the actual performance of the companies that these people are the heads of. I mean, obviously, they do well when the companies prosper, but they often do spectacularly well even when they run the companies into the ground, as we've seen in recent years. And Washington has played a role in that as well, mostly just by blocking any attempt to exercise any oversight, any effort that's gone to try to encourage the capacity of shareholders or other groups to exercise a role in corporate governance has been blocked. You know, one of our favorite lines in the book is we recount a story that the head of the SEC under Clinton tells about when they were considering some, you know, fairly modest regulations that would have given shareholders a little bit more leverage in these situations. And the head of the SEC, Levitt, gets called in by Phil Graham, who at that point is the head of the Senate Banking Committee, basically the person who has a lot of control over the SEC's budget. And Graham says to him, unless the water is crimson with the blood of investors, we don't want you engaging in any regulatory flights of fancy. It wasn't long after this that, in fact, the water is crimson with the blood of investors. But Graham, in our book, emerges as a, you know, one of sort of the prototypical figures in developing this very tight connection between winner-take-all politics and winner-take-all economics.
What are the big fixes that might correct the problems that we're facing?
The central message of our book is that politics is at the heart of the problem, and therefore politics has to be at the heart of the solution. Our view is that these problems are not inevitable. They're not beyond our control. Changes in public policy and government are going to have to be at the heart of the solution. We argue that the first order challenge is to think about how to make a new politics in the United States, not a new economy. And I would say that the number one target for the short term will have to be thinking about how to make our political system more responsive to the middle. And that means
both making it so that we can actually pass things that matter to Americans. And right now we have a filibuster that requires 60 votes in the Senate on every major issue. It's never been that way in the past, and it's a huge roadblock to addressing middle-class concerns. And it also means, and this is a longer-term proposition, but just as crucial, in fact, more crucial, is that we need to figure out ways how to bring Americans more broadly into the political process on the same or relatively similar footing to those who are highly organized right now, the affluent and the ultra-conservative. We need to create middle-class organizations. Rebuilding the labor movement is obviously part of that, but that's a long-term proposition. I think in the short term, we have to figure out ways in which to make politicians more accountable to middle-class voters by increasing both their information and the leverage that they have in the political process.
And the book, again, is called Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. Jacob Hacker, thank you.
Thank you.
Paul Pearson, thank you.
Thanks, Maria.
When we come back, should we change the U.S. Constitution? That's next on the Scholar Circle. Stay tuned.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's up there.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. For decades, the U.S. Constitution has been treated as a sacred document that should not be criticized. But some scholars say that many of the provisions within the Constitution are at the root of the problems in the U.S. in governance, in policymaking, and in political discourse. What are the problematic provisions and how can they be addressed? We have three experts with us. Sanford Levinson is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and most recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Louis Michael Seidman is also with us. Louis Michael Seidman is professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law School. His books include Silence and Freedom, Our Unsettled Constitution, A New Defense of Constitutionalism and Judicial Review, and his latest on constitutional disobedience. Professor David Law is also with us. He is professor of law and political science at Washington University in St. Louis. He is co-author of The Declining Influence of the United States Constitution and The Myth of Imposed Constitutionalism in Japan. Thank you for being with us. We have two of you who have argued that the Constitution is archaic. And Michael Seidman, you have even said downright evil. Sandy Levinson, you've called it imbecilic and maybe even pathological. Some pretty strong words. I thought we should get to why we use such strong words, starting with a historic perspective. Michael Seidman, let's start with you here. You argue that the original framers really have no sense of what we're facing today. And furthermore, constitutional disobedience has helped the country grow and prosper. Give us some examples of this.
I'm happy to do that, but first let me just, maybe this a quibble, but I didn't say the Constitution was evil. I said there are some provisions in the Constitution that are evil. The Constitution also has lots of good things in it, and to the extent that there are good things in it, we ought to follow them not because they're in the Constitution, but because they're good things. But to the extent there are bad things in it, there's no reason to follow those just because people 200 years ago thought that they were good things. Now, in terms of the history of this, there actually is a long history in our country of skepticism about the Constitution. It really goes back to the founding. Certainly the anti-federalists who opposed the Constitution had lots of doubts about it, but some of the people at the Constitutional Convention had doubts as well. In the Federalist Papers, the phrase parchment barriers appears in a number of places. And what was meant by that was doubts that a piece of paper could actually protect basic liberties. On top of that, Thomas Jefferson was a complex and sometimes contradictory thinker, but throughout his life, he voiced deep skepticism about the constitutional enterprise. And the most important decision of his presidency, the purchase of the Louisiana Territory, he himself thought violated the Constitution. And a number of other great presidents, including Wilson, Lincoln, both Roosevelts in one form or another, at one time or another, expressed pretty deep skepticism about the Constitution. So my own view is constitutional skepticism is as American as apple pie. It is part of our tradition.
Sandy Levinson, you've also looked at historic aspects of the Constitution and its strengths, its workability, when it seemed to work better for the U.S., when people were willing to talk about it. What would you add to this?
I think that the primary mistake we make is to assume that what by stipulation might have made sense 200 to 225 years ago really is good for us today. I don't engage in much of what I call founder bashing. I think that the people who wrote the Constitution were facing real problems and did the best they could. The problem is that we have tended to treat them not simply as wrestling with the problems of their own time, but as making decisions for our time. And I think that what is imbecilic is the way the Constitution structures our politics today and the extent to which we venerate the Constitution rather than engage in rational scrutiny. What I most admire about the founding generation was their ruthless attitude of rational scrutiny toward the Articles of Confederation and their view that they and we should always learn the lessons of experience. And I think that part of those lessons, a very important part, should be the extent to which the Constitution doesn't serve us well today, as well as, you know, the extent to which there may be some admirable parts about it. But I think that we are so inflicted with in a culture of Constitution worship and founder worship that there is nobody on the national scene who is leading any sort of serious discussion of the adequacy of the Constitution. And I think Mike made a very, very important point when he said that many of our most important presidents have, in fact, tried to lead national discussions about the adequacy of the Constitution. And that is what is wholly and completely lacking in our politics today.
What I'll want to get back to, of course, is even if we were to find these flaws, something that you've pointed out, Sandy Levinson, which is that it's nearly impossible to change it. One other note, you mentioned how much we are attached to this document. I think it was Robert Dahl who called it a civic religion, that people treat it like a religion. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes. The first book I wrote was called Constitutional Faith, and it really tried to develop the religious overtones that are attached to the Constitution, I think much to our detriment.
This is Mike Seidman. If I could just add to that, I've had some personal experience with this just over the last week or so. I wrote a column in the New York Times that made many of the points that Sandy just made so ably. I've gotten over 1,000 emails since then from many, many people who acted as if I had attacked their religious beliefs, that I was attacking God and the Bible. It was just really an extraordinary reaction. And what's so puzzling about it to me is I would have thought some propositions were really just, to coin a phrase, self-evident. And one of them is, this is our country. We live in it. We have the right to have the kind of country we want to have. Nobody would be happy if France told us what kind of country we had, or the United Nations told us what kind of country we should have. So it seems very odd that people should feel so strongly that these folks who lived over 200 years ago, who know nothing about our current life, who are all dead, and who probably did not represent a majority of the country even when they spoke, that they should have this kind of dictatorial control over fundamental aspects of our polity. It seems really strange that anybody should think that, much less that they should feel so strongly about it.
I would say part of those may have also come from the headline the New York Times gave your piece. I think that scares people.
This is Sandy Levinson. If I can jump in for just one moment and offer a slightly different perspective. The Times published my op-ed, and they called it Our Imbecilic Constitution. And I got a lot of the same kind of responses that Mike is describing. But I would also emphasize that there was a decent percentage of responses of the type, kind of, finally, I thought I was the only person who thought there was something screwy about the Constitution and the power it gives small states in the Senate, or the difficulty of change, or the Electoral College, or some of the other problems. A number of people have pointed out that currently roughly 20% of the American population describes themselves as religious nonbelievers, but they're really almost frozen out of the public discourse because every at least elected political leader seems to feel some necessity to indicate religious commitments. So I think that there is actually some portion of the population that might be open to a serious discussion of constitutional inadequacy, but our elected political leaders, including the two Harvard graduates who ran for president just a couple of months ago, are providing no leadership whatsoever in having any kind of discussion about what a 21st century constitution might look like.
And that's something we should talk about in a bit as well. But let's bring in David Law. Professor Law, you have looked at this constitution in a comparative context. How do others deal with this, and how does the U.S. Constitution fare in the course of history?
Other countries are much more serious about revising and updating their constitutions than we are. It's a bit ironic that the U.S. pioneers this idea of self-determination by committing oneself to rules and principles that are the result of rational self-deliberation. Let's get together and write a constitution and actually put down on paper how we think things should work. And then we turn around and we're the one country that actually doesn't ever really do this anymore, right? So Jefferson urged we should have a constitutional convention every 19 years. That actually turns out to be the average lifespan of a constitution. The average lifespan of a constitution is 19 years. Ours is 225 plus years and counting. So faced with the fact that our constitutional operating system is equivalent to Windows 0.1, other countries see and recognize this, and they look at the formal document and they go, look, even if we wanted to copy the American constitutional system, we would not start with the document. We would not take this large C constitution. Instead, we might look at their small C constitution, which includes, you know, their judicial opinions, it includes their statutes, it includes their practices, it includes their conventions, but we certainly wouldn't adopt this thing that they've got called their constitution. So one thing that's clear is other countries don't consider the document as it currently exists a good template. And I think given that we have this old unamended document that doesn't even describe what we do, you know, doesn't mention political parties, which are fundamental to our system, it doesn't mention the administrative state, which is fundamental, it doesn't mention the concentration of power in the presidency, president now being directly elected, you know, there are two options that make sense, right? We could actually try to revise the Constitution and address its most glaring defects, which Professor Levinson and others have urged at length and in various works, including Sandy's book, Undemocratic Constitution. That's one option. A second option that's reasonable is we could give up on the idea that the Constitution sets forth binding legal rules that address contemporary disputes and view it instead, as Mike urges, as a work of art that is designed to evoke mood or emotion rather than a legal document that commands specific outcome. Whether or not one agrees with Professor Seidman's position, whether or not we agree that we should detach from the Constitution, if we don't fix it, if we don't update it, we are in fact going to increasingly detach from the Constitution. Whether or not we agree with this prescription, what he's describing is in fact going to happen increasingly. So what I think all three of us agree on is that relying on the current Constitution in its current form is a non-starter. But we seem to be stuck with that thanks to some combination of ancestor worship, treatment of the Constitution of civic religion, and the sorts of things that Sandy's mentioned. Pretending we're governed by this thing, this U.S. Constitution, rather than this larger mass of things, the statutes, the conventions, the understandings, Supreme Court decisions, that's a legal fiction. You know, it's really an act of ventriloquism. It's getting the document to say what nine justices want it to say, right? That's not really the Constitution. Don't look at, I think Mike likes the expression, the man behind the curtain, right? So what you see front and center on stage is the large C Constitution. That, as a descriptive matter, that's no longer the way that things are done. And other countries recognize that, and that's why they don't use the U.S. Constitution as a template anymore.
This is Mike Seidman again. If I could just add to that, I think David is absolutely right that one of the problems here is a kind of willful blindness or hypocrisy about what's going on. But there's another problem also that neither David nor Sandy's mentioned, and that is that our addiction to the Constitution tends in an unhelpful way, I think, to raise the temperature of political debate. Think, for example, about gun control, which is a subject that Sandy has written more perceptively about than anybody, I think. The issues about gun control are authentically hard, and people feel strongly about them, and of course there's going to be argument about it. But what happens when the issue is constitutionalized? Well, that has two really unfortunate effects. One effect is that means the lawyers get a hold of it, which means the lawyers do what lawyers do, which is to say they read the text very carefully and they look at the history and try to figure out the connection between the English Declaration of Rights and the Bill of Rights and so on. And they end up talking about stuff that's profoundly irrelevant to the issues today about guns. But the other thing that happens is once it gets attached to the Constitution, then we're not just having a policy disagreement or even a disagreement about philosophy. We're having a disagreement about the nature of the United States, and people start accusing other people of violating our foundational charter and so not being real Americans. And this is a serious obstacle to having the kind of discourse that in a rational, mature democracy we ought to be having about issues that matter.
So what you're saying is it's having a silencing effect.
I'm not sure silencing is quite the right word. In some ways, it's the opposite. It causes people to start yelling at each other instead of listening to each other.
This is David Law. I would just add, I agree completely with the point that Mike is making. The constitutionalization of public policy disputes is democracy stunting. Rather than folks, you know, I was born and raised in Canada, and if you have a policy issue in Canada, you ask yourself, what makes sense? What should the country do? What should the government do? Increasingly, the same sorts of questions come up in the U.S. in the form of, well, what does the Constitution command or forbid or require? And if the idea of democracy is we're supposed to be responsible for ourselves, we're supposed to engage in self-determination. Instead of engaging in self-determination, we engage in this pseudo-historical inquiry into what we think people might have had in mind 225 years ago. That is not democracy.
Sandy, I heard you coming in. Sandy Levinson?
Yeah, I agree with both Mike and David. I think Mike makes a very important point that lawyers take over the show, I think generally to our detriment. For me, the worst example of this has to do with the issue of impeachment. I happen to think that one of the real defects of our political system is that we can't fire a president in whom we lose confidence. During the Clinton administration, obviously, we went through this charade of impeachment, and it turned out to be lawyers fighting one another about the meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors instead of having what might have been a more cogent discussion of whether Bill Clinton's behavior had simply so disgraced the presidency that he should have the decency to leave, as would have happened, I think, say, in Great Britain, or whether, to take a much more telling example for me, whether one had really lost so much confidence in George W. Bush as the commander-in-chief that he should be fired. We can't have that discussion because there is no procedure for a vote of no confidence. Instead, lawyers shout at one another about impeachment I think, to our detriment, and as Mike said, with regard to gun control and with regard to so many other issues, this is the way too much public discourse proceeds in the United States. I'd like to make one other point, a kind of modest disagreement with what David Law said. One of the real anomalies of American constitutional politics is that we venerate the United States Constitution and find the idea of a new constitutional convention almost literally unthinkable. But if you look at the American states, there have been over 225 constitutional conventions over our 200 years. Each American state has had an average of nearly three constitutions. So if you look at the practice of Americans at the state level, you find kind of a marvelous willingness to treat constitutions instrumentally, to ask how do they need to be updated, to amend them. Indeed, the usual critique that a lot of people have about state constitutions is that they're too easy to amend. But it does seem to me that Americans have a curious sort of schizophrenia, where at the state level, we've been remarkably creative with some frequency in revising constitutions, and at the national level, we're really stuck in the late 18th century.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're exploring America's reverence for the U.S. Constitution and how to address the problems that arise from it. Sandy Levinson, let me engage you on this just a bit because of the gridlock that you have written about, and I think that some of the other professors have also. Some people argue that the gridlock is, to some extent, a good thing because it acts to prevent bad laws from being enacted, especially in light of the way the interest group power has grown in the lawmaking process, and it prevents certain majorities from oppressing minorities or limiting their rights in some way or another. But even with the states changing their constitutions under the umbrella of, say, the Bill of Rights, which, as we know, did not come with the original Constitution, but it prevents those states from violating rights, like we saw some in California, for example, but it is now traveling to the Supreme Court. So do you see any good in the gridlock?
It's undoubtedly true that the harder it is to pass legislation, and at the national level, it is almost incredibly hard to pass legislation at times, it's going to block some terrible legislation. But it will also block good legislation, and I think that we have to decide ultimately what we fear more, which risks we're most obsessed by. One thing we learn from an early age in America is to be almost obsessed by the problem of tyranny of the majority, and therefore to say, well, the way to prevent tyranny of the majority is to make it very, very difficult, at times nearly impossible, for the majority to govern. That does, in fact, protect us against those majorities that want to be tyrannical. It does nothing whatsoever, however, to protect us against minority tyranny. That is a tyrannical status quo, whether it's slavery, patriarchy, or other kinds of examples that we could give, where the near impossibility of change simply freezes into a kind of permanence an unjust status quo. Frankly, I would rather run the risk of having legislation passed that I really don't like and then rely on the next election to throw the rascals out and repeal their bad legislation than to continue with a system that makes it nearly impossible to confront any of the great issues that face us in the 21st century, whether you're on the left, right, or center, that each of us has a menu of issues that we really have to confront. And I think that one of the things that unites the Tea Party with the Occupy movement today is the well-merited belief that if you look at Congress, they're incapable of responding adequately to any of these issues. This is one of the things, I think, that accounts for the fact that Congress has an approval rating these days of about 12 to 15%.
Before we dig more into this, I really would like to hear from David Law how other countries and other constitutions deal with these kinds of issues.
I would start by saying that most countries have a more healthy relationship with their constitution than we do, in the sense that they are willing to work with it and they do not fetishize it, put it on a pedestal. Most countries approach the document more as a functional thing, a thing that sets forth how the government's supposed to work and is a framework for government, and rather than something that they're afraid to touch, something that sort of exists behind plexiglass, museum glass. And that means that constitutionalism in other countries looks like constitutionalism, as Sandy described, at the state level. Other countries are willing to revise their documents on a fairly frequent basis. So they don't have to read into the Constitution things that aren't there. In terms of the fear of tyranny of the majority, a lot of countries have the opposite concern, which is the fear of what the French call gouvernement des juges, you know, government by judges. There are a lot of parliamentary systems in the world that are premised on the idea of a more pure democracy, one that can't be stopped by the judges. Who elected the judges anyway to say what legislation can or can't be passed? But the trend is toward increasing acceptance of judicial review and increasing willingness to allow the judges to enforce the Constitution. If there is a global trend, it is in fact in favor of allowing the courts to limit the scope of legislation in the name of the Constitution. But that's less dysfunctional when you're willing and able to revise and update your Constitution on an ongoing basis. If you actually work with your Constitution and you update it, you're not tying yourself to what people did 225 years ago. You're tying yourself to decisions you made maybe 10 or 20 years ago, which is vastly more reasonable.
Michael Seidman.
You know, it seems to me when you asked Sandy how you balance majority against minority tyranny, you asked him exactly the right question. And the point I'd like to make is the problem with constitutionalism is that it takes that question off the table. So when Sandy talks about the fear of minority tyranny, he's very persuasive. And when I've listened to him, I think, you know, he's probably right. When I hear other people on the other side, I have some sympathy with them also. This is a hard question, and it's one we need to grapple with. But as long as you have constitution worship, we can't even talk about it, because the Constitution, for better or worse, sets up a system, and the assumption people have is that we're stuck with it, and therefore it's not worth talking about changing it, or worse yet, if you even think about changing it, you're some kind of commie un-American. And so we never get to the hard and important questions that Sandy has written about in his last two terrific books.
Where do we go from here? Sandy Levinson, you have talked a bit about doing some kind of constitutional convention. You've talked about ensuring that you leave out particular kinds of people, namely the Congress. How would you see something like this going?
Unfortunately, almost any answer sounds quixotic, precisely because there is no national leadership and there's no mass movement. That being said, what I would hope is that people would realize that we really do need to confront the Constitution as a whole, and the best way to do that by far is in a new constitutional convention, and the Constitution itself contemplates the possibility of new conventions. There is a procedure by which Congress must call a convention. I think Congress can call a convention at its discretion. One of the reasons I would exclude Congress is Congress has more than enough that it needs to be thinking about. So one of the reasons to have a constitutional convention is precisely so you could have a group of people who would have the time to debate one another about what sorts of institutions would well serve us, and then to make proposals to the country. I find my own ideas quite reasonable, but I also think it's quite obvious, as I say, that there is no movement that is pushing them, and there is nobody at the national level of politics who's really willing to take any sort of lead. And that's what I find so completely dispiriting, that you have pundits across the political spectrum who increasingly describe the American political system as dysfunctional, even pathological. But they're unable to connect the dots and to say that the Constitution makes its own contribution to the dysfunctionality of the pathology.
You mentioned the money in politics issue, and that does seem to be the issue that might bring another amendment forward. The president himself has said he would support an amendment to overturn Citizens United.
This is Mike Seidman. Finally, I think you have a little disagreement between the three of us. I'm not in favor of a constitutional convention, and I'm not in favor of constitutional amendments. Just as I resent people who died 2 centuries ago ruling us, so I don't think we have a right to rule people 2 centuries from now. And the problem with a constitutional convention and with amendments is that, again, they are efforts to entrench the status quo. So the one sort of amendment I would favor, or the first business of a constitutional convention, if we're going to have one, would be amending Article 5, which provides for amendments and making it much easier. But even if that were done, I think a lot of the pathologies that we've just identified would also attach to trying to write a new constitution. I don't think we need a constitutional convention. I think we need a change in our culture. Now, how do you bring that about? Sandy's right. Anything you propose is certainly going to sound quixotic, but cultural changes happen at the ground level first, and we could all start the process by the next time somebody says to any of us, that's unconstitutional, we should say in response, so what? And if enough people do that, then people are going to start wondering, so what? And then a lot of things that don't seem possible now might suddenly become possible.
David Law, was that you coming in?
Yes, if I may. I agree with Mike that amending Article 5 would be a great idea, making constitutional amendment a little easier. We know as a matter of actual empirical data that constitutions that are too difficult to change, that are too rigid in a sense, don't have the same longevity as constitutions that are a little more supple. Now, obviously, the U.S. Constitution has done a great job, even though it's been very rigid. But on the whole, a little flexibility, not too much, but a little flexibility turns out to be good for constitutional longevity. Now, if you make the Constitution easier to change, then the difference between the Constitution and a regular statute becomes a matter of degree rather than a matter of kind. Countries have this document called the Constitution, but it's not entrenched. So there are really, you know, two separate questions here. Do you want to change the Constitution or ditch it? And do you want the Constitution to be entrenched?
It's a perfect place to end. Let me thank the three of you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Sanford Levinson is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith and, most recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Louis Michael Seidman is professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law School. His books include Silence and Freedom and his latest on constitutional disobedience. Professor David Law is professor of law and political science at Washington University in St. Louis. He is co-author of The Declining Influence of the United States Constitution and The Myth of Imposed Constitutionalism in Japan. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can get it from kpfk.org and click on the archives, or from scholarscircle.org. Have a great day, and we'll see you next week.